Welcome to the Real Estate Guys radio program. I'm your host, Robert Helms. There's a lot of talk in the media about taxes, tariffs, and trade. What does all that mean to real estate investors? That's what we're going to talk about today, and we've got a great guest on the Real Estate Guys radio program.
Stop for a moment. Why are you listening to this show? Are you dreaming of a bigger, brighter financial future? More personal freedom to live life on your own terms? What if there was just one skill that could make it happen? There is. Sales. Robert Kiyosaki says every entrepreneur must be good at sales. It's true for investors too. Sales is how you attract money, people, and opportunities. Sales is the skill used to negotiate deals and lead your team. Sales skills are essential to success. The good news is, it's a learnable skill. The great news is, we've created a two-day interactive workshop to teach those skills to you. Make plans today to attend How to Win Funds and Influence People, Mastering the Art of Financial Selling. For dates and details, send an email to sales@realestateguysradio.com or visit realestateguysradio.com and look under events. Gain the skills you need to succeed. Email sales@realestateguysradio.com or look under the events tab at realestateguysradio.com.
Welcome to the Real Estate Guys radio show. I'm your host, Robert Helms. Thanks for tuning into the program with me, as usual, financial strategist and co-host Russell Gray.
Hey, Robert.
You know, I know you read a lot of headlines, and you've probably been paying attention to all this talk and tweets of tariffs. And a lot of folks, I think, go around day to day, and they don't really understand what tariffs are, how they work, why they work, any of that kind of stuff. And, of course, that's not really what our show is about. But one of our premises is, as a real estate investor, you've got to understand the economic and financial sea that you swim in. And it means you have to have a basic understanding of all things economic. And I think understanding tariffs, especially in light of what's happening, could make some good sense right now.
Yeah, well, there's a couple of things. I mean, if you go back and look at the United States, before 1913, we didn't have an income tax except for that little period of time during the Civil War. When we instituted an income tax to pay for that. But other than that, we didn't have an income tax. So we funded our federal government through tariffs. That's the way it got done. So, you know, it is a tax. It's a tax on people that want to sell into our markets. And that, you know, is not something that we rely upon anymore. But it's being used right now as leverage in a negotiation, trying to level the playing field. So you may agree or disagree with Trump's what he's trying to accomplish, or you may agree or disagree with his methodology. But the fact is, he seems pretty dead set about doing it. He's not backing up. He's not backing down. When he can't get his way, he doubles down and he's pushing ahead. So as real estate investors, we have to look at that and we have to say, okay, what does this kind of really mean? And what does it mean to me? One of the things of any kind of tax or tariff or interest rate change or changes in energy prices or inflation, those are all things that enter into components of cost. And it affects the cost of things in the economy. So that's one part of it. And then the other part of it is the idea of why he's doing it is to even the playing field and bring more manufacturing jobs back to the U.S. If he's successful at doing that, there's going to be certain former manufacturing towns that were once boom towns that became ghost towns that could resurrect. We've already begun to see some of that. So that's what makes all of this really interesting to real estate investors, is to be a little bit ahead of the curve, because obviously by the time everybody else sees it, by the time it becomes completely obvious what's going on, a lot of the people that are looking further down the horizon have already made their moves, and you're chasing the trend instead of riding the wave. And so that's why we spend so much time trying to look down the horizon and talk to people who see a much bigger picture than we do.
Well, and that's super important. I mean, as real estate investors, we tend to operate in our own little cocoons. We're in our particular neighborhoods, in our markets. We have our team, which is all great. But sometimes there's this inbred thinking. One of the things we always urge people to do is to come out to live events, not just real estate events. In fact, we just had a chance to run into our guest at the Money Show in Las Vegas. That's an event that happens several times a year in lots of different cities. And Kim, who's been running that show, has been doing it for a long, long time. And it's really not real estate, although I will tell you, I sat in on a half day of presentations by REIT managers, which was fascinating, a way to invest in real estate as a stock. But Other than that, it's mostly stocks and new companies and all that kind of stuff. But our guest had some strong feelings about this very topic. And when we were caught up in the last downturn and wondering, wow, why didn't we see that coming? We went on a search to find someone who had seen it coming. And Peter Schiff was one of those guys. In fact, he called the mortgage meltdown 2 years before it happened in writing. Peter is an author, a stockbroker, a financial commentator, and a regular fixture at the Real Estate Guys Summit at Sea every year. I think next year will be his eighth in a row, Summit at Sea. But just warning, fair warning, he's opinionated, he's not a Trump fan, and he's got some strong ideas. So when we come back, we'll hear from Peter Schiff, and then we'll talk about what that means for real estate investors. You're tuned to the Real Estate Guys radio program. I'm your host, Robert Helms.
Real estate investment advice right in your mailbox. Sign up for the free Real Estate Guys newsletter at realestateguysradio.com.
Forbes rated Memphis the best cash flow market in the nation. And our good friend Terry Kerr at Mid-South Homebuyers has been the premier turnkey rental property provider in Memphis for over 13 years. With an A-plus rating from the Better Business Bureau, Terry has renovated over 750 houses. Real Estate Guys listeners have snapped up hundreds. Discover what these satisfied investors already know. Mid-South's properties are completely renovated with a one-year warranty and a lifelong rental guarantee. They're affordable, well-managed, and easy to own. Perfect for beginning investors and veterans alike. Get in on the action. Contact Terry and his team via email at midsouth@realestateguysradio.com.
If you want to learn how you could potentially increase your net worth by over $1 million and quit your job in just a few short years, listen closely for the next 60 seconds. This is Brad Sumrock, and over the past 16 years, I've helped thousands of people invest profitably in real estate, but not just any type of real estate. I specialize in helping people syndicate large apartment buildings so that they can be business owners and investors. In today's competitive environment, it's even more important than ever to leverage an experienced mentor, invest in your education, and have a team of advisors that has established relationships nationwide. And so many people right now seem to be struggling to find deals and then get them funded, but yet Sumrock students are thriving in today's marketplace. We've purchased nearly 7,000 units and nearly $500 million in purchase volume over the past 12 months. And with the new Trump tax laws, apartment investors are positioned now better than ever before to pay even less in taxes. To find out more, send an email to apartmentsnow@realestateguysradio.com and you'll get my recent presentation called Why Apartments Now. That's apartmentsnow@realestateguysradio.com.
This is Gary Johnson, and I'm here to say, listen to the Real Estate Guys.
Welcome back to the Real Estate Guys radio program, now in our 22nd year of broadcast. And if you're feeling good, here's a man that can fix that. Let's say welcome back to Peter Schiff. Hey, Peter.
Hey, nice to be with you again.
Always good to hang out with you, my friend. You know, we're in an interesting time, and we had a crazy market at the end of November, December. Then it was back up. And what are people to make of this? We're at a conference where you're often speaking and warning people about debt and challenges, and yet meanwhile the market's gone up. Where do you think we are?
Well, you know, the market started to come way down at the end of last year, and that wasn't the crazy part. That was the sane part. The crazy part was that it went way up.
Right.
Now the question is, why did it start to fall? Well, because investors finally understood what was in store for the markets if the Fed continued to do what everybody believed it was going to do, which was continue to ratchet up interest rates and to leave its quantitative tightening program on autopilot, right? They were going to continue to sell about $50 billion a month of treasuries and mortgage-backed securities into the market and keep raising interest rates. Well, the problem is they kept interest rates at zero for a long time. And during that time, everybody borrowed a bunch of money.
Right.
Right. Because it was so cheap. And that was, of course, what the Fed wanted. They wanted everybody borrowing and spending. So everybody levered up and they had all this debt. But, you know, as interest rates started to rise, that meant carrying that debt was a much bigger burden. And if the Fed was going to keep selling mortgages and selling treasuries, that was going to put more upward pressure on long-term interest rates. You can already see at that time the housing market was rolling over. Big drops. The home builders were getting killed. Prices were falling. Autos, same thing. The inventories were building. Sales were falling. Those are very interest rate sensitive parts of the economy because most people in America don't have the cash to even buy a car, let alone a house. So they have to borrow the money. And so the Fed was making that more expensive. And the markets had been ignoring those problems until all of a sudden they didn't ignore it anymore. And the market started to fall. And we actually officially got down to a bear market very quickly. And the market probably would have kept falling, but for the Fed coming to the rescue by saying, okay, wait a minute, we didn't mean that. We're actually not going to keep raising rates. We're done. And, you know, we're going to stop shrinking our balance sheet this summer. So forget about going back down to where we started. You know, we're barely going to get below $4 trillion, and then we're done. And the markets then, you know, basically had a relief rally. Oh, this is great. And then even people started to think, you know, the Fed's going to cut. The market started pricing in rate cuts instead of rate hikes. And so that's what fueled a rebound in the market. And I didn't think we would make it up to new highs. And not every index made new highs, but some of them did.
Yeah.
The Dow did, the NASDAQ. But the New York Stock Exchange, Russell 2000 didn't make new highs. I think the transports made new highs. And now we're rolling over again. And I still don't think the market has fallen enough given the new information. Because part of the rally, what fueled the rally to new highs was not just the Fed, but it was the belief that Trump was going to deliver this fantastic trade deal because he kept tweeting, we're almost there. Oh, everything is great. It's going to be the greatest deal ever. It's a beautiful deal. We're almost there. It's, you know, and every time Trump said something, the market went up. In fact, whenever the market started to go down, he would like, oh, trade deal going great. And then, yeah, and then it would get the market to go higher. But now it's pretty obvious that there is no deal. And not only is there not a deal, but we are escalating the war. We are increasing the tariffs, and Trump is like, bring it on.
Right.
Trump is like not trying to avoid the war, he thinks we're gonna win. In fact, he thinks that the war itself is a victory. We don't even have to win the trade war, we're gonna win just fighting it. And so the market should be getting killed right now because, I mean, this is crazy talk.
Well, when that happened, right, the market took a huge dive, 700 points or something, the day that the whole thing broke, and then bounced back pretty well.
Well, right? I mean, it was back today a couple hundred points.
Yeah.
But 700 is not a huge dive.
Not percentage-wise, right.
I mean, the market should have been down much more. There's too much complacency because the conventional wisdom is that we win the trade war. And there's some arguments over who's going to pay the tariffs. Maybe we pay some. But everybody thinks at the end of the day, we win, that we got China just where we want them. And that's not the case. You know, I did on my podcast that I did, I said, you know, Trump reminds me of Custer, you know, and the confidence that he rode into Little Bighorn, right? Thinking like, oh, this is going to be easy, right? We're going to kill them Indians, right? And I had no idea what he was in for. And I think the same thing is going to happen with this trade war. I not only are we not going to win it, we're going to lose it badly. Because I think people don't really understand the nature of this relationship and just who's been, you know, living off of who, right? Trump says that the Chinese are taking advantage of us, right? Because they're selling us all this stuff. And they're like, you know, it's $500 billion a year we're losing. What are we losing? We print that money for nothing. We just run it off a printing press. That's all the Chinese are getting.
And we buy goods and services, mostly goods, right?
Yeah, what are we getting from China? Everything.
Yeah.
All sorts of stuff. It's all manufactured products that make our lives better. I mean, people are going to Walmart and buying all this cheap stuff. Where do you think it's coming from? From China, right? So that's a benefit to us. And they're the biggest buyer of our bonds, which means they're our lender. They're lending us money that we would otherwise not have. Right, so they are doing two things. They are lending us money, and they are supplying us with real goods.
Yeah.
And all we give them is pieces of paper. So our lives are better, and they just have a stack of paper.
Which is arguably worth less every day they hang on to it.
It's just an IOU.
Yeah.
You know, they have a bunch of treasuries, you know, and stuff like that. So I think that if we stop trading with China, right, well, what happens? Well, the Chinese have all their stuff, and we just have all of our paper. Who's worse off? Who's better off? And what's the harder job? See, Donald Trump keeps saying, well, you know, we'll just make the stuff ourselves. That's easier said than done.
Right.
Right. So take, like, you know, I mean, look at Nike as an example, right? Big footwear company. They have a lot of employees in the U.S., but they don't have anybody employed in manufacturing the shoes. Right? They just design them and market them and stuff like that. But all that work is done in China.
Yeah.
Right? So in order to avoid the tariffs, now, of course, they can start importing from other countries because they a lot of their shoes are made outside of China. So they can keep doing that. But what Trump is saying is he wants all that to come home, right? He wants U.S. companies to manufacture here, right? So what would be involved in order for Nike to do that? Because there's no shoe factories anymore in America. So you'd have to build the factories. And then you'd have to buy the equipment to make the shoes. But then you need all the supplies, right? You need all the rubber and the leather and the laces and all the different things. So we don't have any of that. So now we have to start having rubber farms and to have supply. So just to put that together, I mean, let's say it can be done in 5 or 10 years. A, what do we do in the meantime for shoes, right? But what's that going to cost? Where's Nike going to get the money?
The labor is going to be so much more expensive.
Well, first they have to train the people. I mean, we don't have any, nobody knows how to do any of that. So you got to train them and then you got to pay them. So look, it would cost a fortune and there would be a huge depression between, because we have an economy that's built on consumption and services and built on the fact that we don't have to do any of this stuff. Chinese will do it for us. We just print some money and hey, so if we have to go back to do it the way we used to do it, it's going to require a tremendous change in our economy. And when we were a big manufacturer in the past, we had limited government, lower taxes, fewer regulations, a lot of savings, a skilled workforce. So we don't have that stuff now. So it would be so difficult. Now, in the long run, we're going to have to do this eventually. But if Trump accelerates that to the future because he pisses off the Chinese, we're going to have to endure the pain. But Trump doesn't realize how painful it's going to be. He thinks it's an instant win. He thinks it's so easy to just produce. What's easy is to consume. And that's what the Chinese are going to have. Because think about if Nike decided, we're not buying any more shoes from China, right? Well, the plant that makes the shoes is still there. All the infrastructure, all the supply chains are still in China. That's all there. All the workers are there. So they can make those shoes very easily. So now they just have to have somebody else buy them. Well, there's 1 billion people in China. They got, that's what, 2 billion feet,
right?
How hard is it to just slip on those shoes? Plus, you know, the Chinese probably have smaller feet, so they could probably, you don't even need as much material, right? So you just make a size 9 instead of a size 12 or whatever they're doing. But that's easy. The easy part is wearing the shoes and putting them on your feet. The hard part is making them. And so people say, well, why don't the Chinese just buy them now? Well, they buy some of them, but they'll be able to buy more. And the real thing is, if the Chinese currency goes up, because one of the things China's threatened to do is, well, we're going to sell treasuries. We're going to stop buying treasuries. We're going to sell treasuries. And people are saying here, oh, you'd never do that because that would cause the dollar to go down. And that'll make it even harder for you to sell your stuff to America. But it'll make it easier to sell their stuff domestically. Because as Americans are getting poorer, the Chinese are getting richer. As the yuan rises in value, now Chinese shoe manufacturers can derive a higher dollar value by selling domestically than exporting to the United States. And so if the Chinese produce the shoes and then wear the shoes, now it's a twofer, right? They get all the jobs associated with production, but now they get to enjoy the fruits of their labor by actually wearing the shoes that they made. See, right now, they labor and we get the fruits. They make the shoes and we get to wear them. So if they get to make them and wear them, that's a win-win. Now, what happens with us? Well, now we have to make shoes that we didn't have to make before, which are going to cost us a fortune, which means we're not going to have that many shoes, so we're not going to have new shoes to wear. So we're the losers, right? The China's the winners. So this is, Trump doesn't realize that he's poking a hornet's nest here because we have been living off of them. Sure, do they rip off some of our intellectual property? Of course, right? What is the actual value of that compared to what we're getting from them? And meanwhile, they're going to keep ripping off that intellectual property because we can't stop it. We can't go to China and enforce our patents in China. Right. So they're going to keep on doing that despite the trade war. So nothing gets accomplished. They keep stealing our intellectual property, but now they're not going to be giving us this big subsidy in the form of loaning us money and supplying us with goods.
We're talking with Peter Schiff. We'll have more when we come back. Plus, we'll play real estate trivia next. You're tuned to the Real Estate Guys radio program. I'm your host, Robert Helms.
Live nationwide, you're listening to the Real Estate Guys. Find out more at realestateguysradio.com.
Are you looking to create sustainable wealth through agricultural real estate? Then look no further than Agro Nosotros. They're a sustainable specialty agriculture company with specialty coffee farming operations in Panama and fine flavor organic chocolate operations in Belize. Over the last 4 years, they've helped ordinary people to diversify outside of traditional real estate and into offshore agricultural real estate. They don't have your typical tenants, termites, and troubles. Their tenants are trees, and they grow and produce two hugely popular and proven products, coffee and chocolate. Through Agro Nosotros, you can own half-acre parcels in your very own specialty coffee or organic cacao farm, turnkey managed on your behalf, that produce passive cash flow for you and your heirs. And you can feel good about where you put your money to work. Agro Nosotros has socially sustainable programs that provide living wages, improved accommodations, and a steady channel to market to literally hundreds of farmers. And so far, they've placed 61 kids in school. To find out more and see how you can get involved, email agro@realestateguysradio.com. That's agro, A-G-R-O, at realestateguysradio.com.
If you love real estate and have always wanted to own your own business, listen up. The Real Estate Guys and their panel of experts want to teach you how to go full-time fast in the real estate syndication business. These next few years may go down in history as one of the best times ever to acquire investment real estate. There are deals everywhere if you know where to look and how to assemble the resources. The Secrets of Successful Syndication Seminar will show you how to make big money doing big deals from a team of experts that have syndicated projects totaling more than $1 billion. Don't wait for someone to give you a raise or create a job for you. Attend the Secrets of Successful Syndication and learn how to build a team, raise capital, find deals, and make full-time money in 6 months or less. Go to realestateguysradio.com and click on events. All the big players use syndication as a way to diversify risk, optimize profits, and earn big money. You can too. Go to realestateguysradio.com and click on events.
Hi, this is Kendra Todd, winner of The Apprentice, and you're listening to The Real Estate Guys.
Welcome back to The Real Estate Guys radio program. Thanks so much for tuning into the show. We're talking about the tariffs and trade, and it's always good to have Peter Schiff on the program.
Yep.
Before we get back to the interview with Peter, it's time to play real estate trivia. That's your chance to win a prize by knowing the answer to our real estate trivia question today, which is going to have something to do with our topic. As soon as you hear the question and think you know the answer, send your best guess to trivia@realestateguysradio.com. The first person with the right answer is going to win an awesome book written by Peter and his brother Andrew called How an Economy Grows and Why It Crashes. It's a very simple book with illustrations, and if you have any doubt about all this kind of stuff, could not recommend this book more strongly. We're going to give away a copy today on Real Estate Trivia. Last week on the show, we were talking about Opportunity Zones. Marisa Arold was with us to give us the update. Now that a lot of the legislation is kind of complete and the rules are more clear. In fact, at the Money Show, there were lots of folks talking up Opportunity Zone funds. We asked this last week, name the least visited state in the U.S. Well, of all the places you could go and visit, the place people visit the least is the fine state of North Dakota. And I'm betting some people from North Dakota are just fine with that. Here's our real estate trivia question for this week. When was the first tariff law passed in the United States? And that may be a stretch of a real estate trivia question, but I did say in the United States, which is a big piece of real estate. When was the first tariff law passed? So Russ mentioned we didn't have an income tax until 1913. We funded our economy through tariffs before that. That's a hint. But when was the first tariff law passed? If you know or just want to take a guess, send your best guess to trivia@realestateguysradio.com. Include your name, the answer to the question, and your mailing address, because if you're the first to do so, you're going to get this great book, How an Economy Grows and Why It Crashes, by Peter and Andrew Schiff. That's today's real estate trivia question, and we're with Peter Schiff talking about all things economy. And, you know, Peter, one of the things that has been brought up, and this is another part of your wheelhouse, is how much the Chinese and the Russian governments are buying gold and putting gold away. How does that fit into this part of the story?
Well, I think the Chinese and the Russians and probably other smarter governments and central banks recognize that the dollar's days as the reserve currency are numbered.
Right.
Now, how big is that number? That's, you know, $64 trillion question. Nobody knows. But if the dollar is going to lose its role as the primary reserve asset for central banks, well, then what will take its place? See, right now, what gives a currency value are the foreign reserves. So if you're a central bank, what's your currency based on? What gives it value? Well, we've got this huge pile of U.S. dollars. These are our reserves.
Yeah.
Right? And we can use these dollars to defend our currency if it comes down. And so that's what's backing it up. Now, of course, before central banks used other currencies as their reserve, everybody used gold. That was what you had. Well, what's backing up your paper? Well, this is real money right here. I've got gold, right? That's what gave the currency value. But when the world went on the dollar standard, people started holding dollars instead of gold. But originally, the reason they did that is because the dollar was as good as gold, because the dollar was gold, and our Federal Reserve notes were actually obligations of the Federal Reserve to pay dollars. So foreign central banks held Federal Reserve notes, which were redeemable on demand in real money, in gold. But in 1971, we basically screwed everybody and said, you know, you've got all these reserves, and we promised to pay you gold. We're not going to give you squat. We're defaulting. You're getting nothing. So, you know, the dollar got marked down, right? Gold went way up. You know, gold went from $35 an ounce to $8.50, and the dollar tanked, but then it stabilized at lower levels, and all these central banks, you know, kept holding the dollar as a reserve, even though it was no longer backed by gold, which was the only reason it was acceptable as reserve in the first place. But I think that because we have abused that privilege so much, we've borrowed so much money, we've printed so much money, we're heading for a currency crisis, a dollar crisis, and in that environment, central banks are going to have to show that their currency is backed by something. Because if it's backed by the dollar and the dollar is sinking, well, then it's backed by nothing.
Right.
And so what's it going to be? And some of these central banks are, you know, buying, oh, I'm going to buy more euros, I'll buy more yen. But, you know, if there really is a crisis on the dollar and the dollar is tanking and people are losing confidence in the dollar, who's to say that they won't also lose confidence in the euro
right.
or the yen? Because like, hey, if the dollar can collapse, why can't the euro? Why can't the yen? So I think that central banks are thinking, okay, we better have actual money, gold, because this is a very different animal. Right? Gold is not the same as paper. So
right.
I think they know that they need to increase the amount of gold that they're holding in reserve, because in the future, that gold is going to be a much more important component of their reserves. And of course, if I'm right, and the price of gold goes 5,000, 10,000 or higher, just that appreciation alone is going to mean that their gold reserves are rising as a percentage of their total reserves, because the gold is rising in price relative to the euro or the yen or what they have. But I think that they need to accumulate more raw ounces, and that's what they're trying to do.
Well, of course, there's a lot of speculation that what we hear they have in reserve isn't the true number, and there's really no way to know that, but a lot of folks believe there's more gold that they have than they're showing.
Yeah, if I were to guess, China probably has more gold than they admit, and we probably have less.
Yeah.
You know, we brag about how much gold we have, but no one's actually ever seen it. No one's audited it.
Right.
So we just have to trust them that they didn't already sell it, you know. So
well, luckily they're quite trustworthy, so that shouldn't be a problem.
Yeah, and anytime somebody asks for their gold, the strangest thing happens. We don't seem to have it to deliver.
We can deliver it 11 years from now. Yeah, crazy. But then on the retail market, gold reacted like you would have thought when the stock market went down 700 points in a day. Gold was up, but
it was
overall
only
it's
up
down.
$12.
It's only up a little
bit. No, the gold is not reacting the way it should.
Yeah,
and I think the reason is because people are still not as concerned as they should be, right? Because if you're not worried, if you look at gold as an insurance policy against currency debasement, inflation, a bear market, you know, economic upheaval, right?
Yeah.
if you don't think any of that is coming, if you think everything is great, if you think Trump has made America great again, and we've got the greatest economy in the history of America, and that nothing can go wrong, and this bull market is going to go on forever, and we're never going to have any more inflation, that the Fed has stomped it out, and the central bankers have now figured out how to stop recessions. You know, they're so smart now, they know exactly how to micromanage the economy, and we're never going to have another recession. People believe all this. Well, then what the hell do I need gold for?
Right.
But when people have a more realistic outlook on the future, they're going to want gold, and they're going to buy it. I mean, it's not like the price hasn't been slowly moving higher. It has since it bottomed out. When the Fed raised rates for the first time in December of 2015, gold bottomed out at 1,050.
Yeah.
So it's been climbing, but it hasn't been an aggressive move. But that's coming as investors take a more realistic outlook about the future, particularly about the future of inflation, because that's really what gold is a hedge against, more than just about, you know, the markets going down or political uncertainty. It's a hedge against inflation. And in fact, if you look at the price of gold right now, in terms of most of the world's currencies, it's at record highs. You know, and especially if you look at the countries where there's been a lot of inflation, let's say in South America, I mean, look at Venezuela, right? Look at how much the price of gold has gone up if you're living in Venezuela.
Right.
And so gold has helped Venezuelans preserve their purchasing power, because if you have the currency, you got to get rid of it, right? And you can buy gold. So that's going to happen for Americans. We're going to start to see, because of when the Fed goes back to zero and they do more QE and the deficit skyrocket and the money printing goes off the charts, we're going to see a big pickup in inflation as measured by consumer prices. I mean, it's already on the rise, but it's going to rise more when the Fed adds fuel to that fire by creating more money. And a lot of people think that, well, a recession will cure that. It's not. It didn't cure it in the 70s. You know, you can have a recession and inflation at the same time. They call it stagflation. But people, we haven't had that in so long. Nobody's worried. In fact, the Federal Reserve, when they did their most recent bank stress tests, right, they tried to come up with the worst case economic scenario they can imagine.
Yep.
And then put the banks through the test. And there wasn't a single scenario where they assumed inflation went above 2%. Not a single one. So as far as the Fed concerned, the worst thing that can happen is that inflation is 2%. In fact, what they thought was worse is that it went down to 1%. So the Fed is actually worried about inflation not being high enough. They don't even worry at all about inflation being too high. And obviously, if they would have stress test these banks for a stagflationary environment where the economy went down, right? So unemployment went up, asset prices fell, so their loans were going bad. But at the same time, inflation was rising so that interest rates were going up. So instead of being a shock absorber by coming down, they actually added to the pain by going up. I mean, all these banks would have failed. None of them would fail that stress test, which is probably why they didn't administer it. But, you know, it's always what you're not expecting, right? Everybody wants to fight the last war, and the Great Recession, the financial crisis, inflation came down, interest rates came down, and everybody assumes, well, the next crisis is going to look just like that one. Well, maybe it will be a mirror image in that interest rates and consumer prices will go up. That's what I think is more likely. And so nobody is prepared for that, and that's exactly what's going to happen.
You know, a lot of folks are saying that based on the nature of what we've seen in the last few years, that, and of course with the Fed rate, that we're not going to see another market of normalization in interest rates, that interest rates have to stay low for a variety of reasons because of treasuries and all that. What do you think it will take for us to sustain an increase in interest rates?
Yeah, well, the problem is, you know, if you are addicted to drugs, you have to keep taking the drug.
Right.
You can't stop. Now, it might be healthy for you to stop, but you don't want to because in the short run, you're not going to feel good. And so that's where we are when it comes to rates. The Fed kept interest rates so low for so long and encouraged all this debt. Now we have all the debt. And if rates go up, that's like the drugs being removed, and that's an economic withdrawal. So the Fed has to keep rates low. Now, most people think because we have so much debt, well, that just means the Fed is going to keep rates low forever. And they assume that can happen. Well, it's not that easy. You just can't keep interest rates low forever. You can do it for a while as long as the bond market doesn't understand what's happening to their value of their money, as long as people believe inflation is contained. So if people think inflation is only going to be 1% to 2%, well, maybe you can keep interest rates at 2% or 3%. I mean, that's still pretty low, But at least, you know, I mean, it's not negative, maybe after taxes. But if inflation moves up to 4 or 5 or 6%, you can't keep rates that low because nobody is going to be dumb enough to lend at those low rates if they know what the inflation rate is. So in order for you to believe that rates are going to be held down indefinitely, you have to believe inflation is going to be held down indefinitely, which doesn't make any sense because in order to keep rates interest rates low, they have to keep on creating inflation. They have to keep on printing money. Now, in the short run, a lot of that inflation has shown up in asset prices, stocks, real estate bonds, you know, collectibles,
yep,
antiques, you know, you name it. A lot of prices have gone up. Eventually, it's going to be consumer prices that are really going to start to rise. So at that point, the Fed now has a very difficult decision to make. Inflation now, let's say it's 3 or 4%. It's, you know, Nixon imposed wage and price controls when it got to 4%. But let's say inflation gets up there. Now, what does the Fed do? The Fed has two choices. Okay, now we really have to jack up rates because let's say inflation is 4%. They might have to take rates up to 6% or 7% to really turn it around.
Yeah.
Well, we have so much debt. I mean, you know, there's no way. So we would have a collapse. Right, the government would have to default on its debts because I don't even think it can pay because it's all short term. It's like an adjustable rate mortgage, and you know, so much debt. So we would have a much worse financial crisis than 08 if the Fed decided to fight that inflation. So then, the other choice is, well, not fight the inflation, just let it be.
Yeah.
Now, of course, they could try to fight it not with higher rates, but just with price controls like Nixon did. But all that does is create shortages in a black market.
Yep.
That doesn't stop prices from rising. That just tries to force the increases to the black market. But if they don't do that, then they just, well, we're just going to allow the inflation to be higher. Well, then the problem is if you allow inflation at 4%, well, then it goes to 5. And if you allow it at 5, it goes to 6. So if you just do nothing, it's like I have an illness, but I'm not going to take any medicine. We're just going to keep getting sicker. And the problem is it's perception. Because if you now own dollars and you see that the Fed is tolerating higher inflation and is going to do nothing to prevent it from accelerating, then it just, that's a self-fulfilling spiral.
Yeah.
Get me out. I want to get out of this. And then, of course, interest rates start to rise despite the fact, because the Fed is trying to keep rates low, but maybe it can keep rates low in the Treasury market. But how's it going to keep them low in the mortgage market unless
right.
it starts buying all the mortgages? But now what about corporate debt? That's going away. It's going to start buying that. What about municipal debt? I mean, now what about credit card or auto? So the Fed's going to be buying. And then it's hyperinflation. Then you destroy the currency. So there is no easy way out. There is no, you know, soft landing from this. This is an economic disaster of historic proportions, no matter what the Fed chooses. But if they try to postpone the consequences for as long as they can, then it will be the inflation that we end up having because they won't fight the inflation. And that's actually, for the economy's perspective, that's a worse outcome. If we actually destroy the currency, that's much worse than just having another financial crisis.
Yeah.
But the problem with this next financial crisis is if they pick that poison, there's no bailouts. There's no we're going to have the full consequences. We didn't get the full consequences when the housing bubble burst.
Right.
This is a bigger bubble. And imagine having to bear the full consequences of this bubble, which is much bigger than the housing bubble and the dot-com bubble combined.
So I guess the operative question is, what's an investor to do? You talk to a lot of investors and you help folks find solutions in these kinds of markets. So talk about what some of the strategies that you guys employ are.
Yeah, well, I have been preparing for this inevitability for a long time. In fact, some people are starting to think, hey, maybe it's never going to happen. I've been preparing for so long. And just when you think it's not going to happen, just when you're giving up, then it happens, right? I mean, so you have to be patient. And nobody knows exactly when something that is inevitable is going to happen. But so many people are acting as if it's never going to happen. And, you know, people found out, they learned the hard way in the real estate bubble that prices don't go to the sky. It doesn't go on forever. And there's no change here. So what you need to do is you need to be out of U.S. financial assets because that's where the bubble is.
Yep.
Right. So out of U.S. stocks in general, U.S. bonds are way overpriced, right, in a portfolio. And so is the U.S. dollar. So if you've got a pension, an IRA, you've got an investment account, and you've been fortunate enough to have been invested in U.S. stocks, and you've seen this big gain, you need to cash in, right? You need to take that gain before the market takes it away from you. And more importantly, even if you don't lose all the nominal gains, right? Even if the Dow only falls by 50%, right? And it could fall a lot more.
Yeah.
But the 50% that you have left is not going to feel like you still got half your money, because the money itself is going to lose so much of its purchasing power. So you got to get out of those types of assets, but then replace them with other portfolio assets. So I'm not telling people, hey, don't own stocks. Just don't own overpriced dollar-denominated U.S. stocks. It's a big world out there. And the relative difference between the valuations on U.S. stocks and foreign stocks has never been this good. You have to go back 100 years to try to find an opportunity like this as far as on a relative basis. So emerging markets, I think, are great. Some of the developed markets are really good as well. As far as value stocks, I mean, value has been out of favor for a while anyway. Everybody's been buying momentum and stuff like that. So there's a lot of opportunity in the right stocks. There's a lot of really good dividend yields out there that you can earn, you know, in the meantime while you're waiting for the stocks to appreciate. But more importantly, because they are international and non-dollar denominated and derive their revenues outside the U.S., when the dollar crashes, these stocks will rise in proportion to that decline. So that helps preserve your purchasing power, right? And then also, of course, investors should have some gold in their portfolio. They should have some physical gold. They can have some gold stocks. You know, I think gold stocks, I mean, which have been in a vicious bear market, probably the worst bear market they've ever had. And, you know, there's been much bigger declines in the price of gold, but this is a very brutal bear market because of the psychology. The psychology for gold has probably never been worse. I mean, it's even worse than it was in 2000, 2001, when gold had fallen for 20 years and everybody was buying the dot-coms. It was a new era. People were more bearish on gold stocks now than they were then. So they're an even better buy now. And, you know, I have a gold fund, EPGFX, is the Euro-Pacific Gold Fund. I started it 5 years ago. And I'm the number one fund. I just got a plaque in the mail from Lipper, but both Lipper and Morningstar, as of now, I'm number one for the last 5 years, for the last 3 years, and the last 1 year. And I'm beating everybody by a pretty big margin. So we're doing great. Not that our investors have made money. They haven't. They've just lost less than everybody else.
Right.
But we've done a good job of picking stocks in a bear market. But I think we're going to do as good, if not better, in the bull market, which hasn't even hit yet. So it's still a great opportunity for people who want to get into gold stocks, because it is a difficult industry, especially we have a lot of small companies, a lot of juniors in there. And, you know, in order to separate, you know, the wheat from the chaff, you got to have somebody who knows the industry, because there's probably more, you know, landmines and gold mines in a lot of these junior loans. So this is a good way to get diversified, get professional management. And when this thing hits, I mean, I think these stocks are going to be home runs, many of these. I mean, some of them will probably go to zero, but we got a diversified portfolio. The ones that go up 50 times, you know, will more than make up for ones that go to zero.
All right, good stuff. There's Peter Schiff. When we come back, we'll tell you how you can find out more about what Peter does and get some of his great books. Thanks for being on the show. It's always good to have you.
Always good to be had.
There's Peter Schiff. More when we come back, you're tuned to the Real Estate Guys radio program. I'm your host, Robert Helms.
Need help with your real estate investment portfolio? Check out the resources page at realestateguysradio.com.
Hey, it's Robert Helms. Thanks so much for listening to the show today. I want to personally invite you to come see an amazing real estate market that combines excellent cash flow, offshore diversification, and what we affectionately call lifestyle investing. Come join me from July 5th to 8th in the beautiful country of Belize. The Real Estate Guys have been bringing investors to Belize for more than 13 years now, and our discovery trip is designed to show you the market like nobody else can. Sure, Belize is breathtakingly beautiful. The people are wonderful. And wait till you taste the food. But the real opportunity is the real estate investment potential. 2018 was the biggest year in tourism Belize has ever witnessed, and this year is starting off strong. How does that translate to real estate investment? That's what you have to come see. There's all types of opportunity in Belize when it comes to real estate, including both long-term and short-term rentals, commercial and retail triple net properties, business opportunities, land acquisition, development, agriculture, and more. And as the only country in Latin America with English as its official language, it's easy to understand the law. Property rights are strong, and contracts are in English. And in Ambergris Key, a unique situation exists where demand for rentals continues to outstrip supply, creating a compelling environment for investors. So come see for yourself. Join me July 5th through 8th in Ambergris Key, Belize, as we study the market, learn about the sustainable drivers, and tour lots of beautiful real estate. And like all of our field trips, there are no properties for sale during the weekend. Rather, you'll meet lots of local providers that will help educate you about the market so you can follow up with them after the trip if the market's interesting to you. But that ball's in your court. You'll receive their contact details, but they won't receive yours unless you give it to them. You've heard about Belize and the real estate guys for all these years. Now come see what all the excitement is about. Plus, we'll have lots of time over meals and activities to talk about all things real estate. To get the details, go to the website at realestateguysradio.com and click on events, where you'll find the Belize Discovery Trips. Once you register, you'll get information about our group hotel rates as well as travel details. So join me in Belize, July 5th through 8th. It's a beautiful country with lots of amazing possibilities, and the only thing missing is you. Go to realestateguysradio.com under events. I look forward to seeing you in beautiful Belize.
Hi, this is Garrett Sutton, Rich Dad's advisor. Remember, equity happens, and you're listening to The Real Estate Guys.
And welcome back to The Real Estate Guys radio program. Hey, if you ever wanted to do bigger deals using other people's money, then come on out to the Secrets of Successful Syndication, two power-packed days and a big workbook with tons of great information on how you can either get started as a syndicator or invest passively in a syndication. All the details on our website at realestateguysradio.com under events. Well, it is always entertaining and a little bit exhausting listening to Peter Schiff.
Yeah, Peter's great. I love Peter. I think Peter challenges my thinking. He really inspires me because he's just not afraid to march to the beat of his own drummer. He thinks things through. He has a logic behind what he believes. He believes it with passion. He acts on it. He walks his talk. And, you know, he'll debate with you. And I've been actually privileged to debate with him on more than one occasion.
Yep.
And we don't always see eye to eye. I think one of the things that's going on for a lot of financial commentators, Peter included, is they don't really understand real estate. And they don't understand the way real estate people think. We've written on that more than a couple times in our newsletter. And Donald Trump is a real estate investor. He doesn't look at things as, in terms of commodities. Everything is an individual relationship. Everything is an individual deal. And that's one part of it. The other thing is he's not afraid to use debt strategically. He's not afraid to go into debt to build things. And so there's this concern. And Peter said, hey, I don't think we're going to win the trade war. I don't know if we're going to win the trade war or not, but it doesn't surprise me that somebody would be willing to run up a deficit and go into debt in order to buy time to go build something, which means get the infrastructure back in place so that we can have that manufacturing back here in the United States. So creating the financial pressure abroad that makes it more enticing for companies to bring their manufacturing back to the U.S., creating a more friendly business environment in the U.S., and then, Robert, you mentioned opportunity zones, creating an environment where there's a motivation for private capital to get involved in investing in major pieces of infrastructure with at least a 10-year commitment. If you listen to last week's show with Mauricio, we talked a little bit about that. We're going to be talking about it in more detail at the Secrets of Successful Syndication, because it's one of the big opportunities right now for syndicators to get involved in these opportunity zones. And you might be a small player in one of those, but the fact is a lot of money is going to be pouring in to infrastructure. And so if you kind of look at that from the big picture through the eyes of a real estate investor, he may not be able to execute it. And you may disagree with, you know, what he's trying to do or that it needs to be done, or there's a lot of, you know, pros and cons, but nobody's calling and asking any of us for our opinion, really, unless it's an opinion talk show. And this isn't. We're just trying to figure out what the heck's going on and what's this guy thinking about and what's he likely to do and what's the likely outcome. So seems to me that he is being very consistent in what it is he's trying to do. And he's moving a lot of different pieces of the puzzle together to bring it all together. Of course, the $64 million question or $64 billion question or $64 trillion question, whatever it is whether or not it'll be successful. But I'm sure that it's going to make a difference in certain markets. And those are really the markets that we want to pay attention to.
Well, I think for real estate investors especially, how do we bring this home? What does it mean to you? Well, there's a couple of things. First of all, I'm going to go out and immediately start a used shoe store, because clearly, if we're not going to have shoes made here, we're going to have to take better care of our old shoes and all that. No, but seriously, let's think about what happens when when we have this kind of trade imbalance. This is a particular country that we get a lot of goods from. And Peter was pretty clear about that. So if that changes, there's a lot of ways it could manifest. I mean, the extreme, I guess, would be we're going to pull all this manufacturing back into the United States. Well, let's think. Does that have anything to do with real estate? Only every aspect of it, where the factories will be located and therefore where the apartments will need to be around that and where the tertiary businesses that support that influx of people will. There's a huge real estate impact. On the other hand, if the tariffs result in the cost of goods going up significantly in the U.S., that's going to affect you a little bit, but it's going to affect your tenant a lot.
Yeah, Craftsman just announced that they're going to be putting a $50 million or a $90 million manufacturing facility in Fort Worth. And it was one of three places they were looking at. I think they were looking in Lansing, Michigan, and one other state, Ohio, I believe it was. And they settled on Texas. And they settled on Texas DFW in particular, and Fort Worth in particular, because they wanted a strong labor pool, they wanted a friendly business environment, and they wanted close proximity to distribution. But in the article that I read on it, the CEO or whoever the decision maker was said, you know, a few years ago, they wouldn't have made that decision. But because of the current environment, it made sense for them to do that. A couple years back, or maybe about a year or so ago, U.S. Steel decided that they were going to reactivate a big plant in Pittsburgh that had been idle for many, many years. And so some of the things that are going on at the geopolitical level to try to create an environment that will entice capital and jobs to create businesses to bring their manufacturing into the U.S. or start manufacturing in the U.S., it's starting to work. And again, you just need to look at that. So I think that's an interesting article. You know, I watch the news all the time and I look for these articles to figure out when it's happening, where it's happening, and then get some insight into why it's happening. What is the reason these people are doing it? Because it gives you some insight into where they may continue to do it. Obviously, we've been big fans of DFW and that marketplace for the last 10 years because of energy, because of distribution, because of the friendly business environment. It's not surprising to us that the economy has grown so well, that the population has grown so big. It's the place that a lot of Californians and people that are being displaced in high tax, high cost of living states, both businesses and people, are landing in. And those are the type of macro trends you look at as a real estate investor to figure out where you can be so you can skate to where the puck is going.
Yeah, you know, tax is just one part of the big picture, but tariffs are taxes. In fact, Steve Forbes was also at this event, and one of the things he said is that regulations are a form of taxation, which you could ponder for a little bit. His premise, Steve Forbes, was that the tax cuts were working, and especially, obviously, for real estate investors. But he also listed his top threats, which were trade, tariffs, the new NAFTA deal, and the Federal Reserve. So no surprises there. Anyway, look to hear from Steve later in the year on this program. If you want to get around, amazing folks, you got to get out and see the world. Maybe you got our email with a lot of events we're going to be speaking at, but we're certainly going to be at the New Orleans Investment Conference coming up in early November in the grand city of New Orleans. Peter will be there. You'll get a chance to hang out with him. In fact, we typically, and we'll do this again this year, have our own little private real estate guy's suite party one of the nights we're in New Orleans, and no doubt Peter will show up. He has every year so far. Maybe this will be the year he stands us up. But also, we typically get Brian London, who's the editor of the Gold Newsletter and the host of the conference, to stop by. If Chris Martinson and Adam Taggart from Peak Prosperity are there, they'll stop by. Anyway, we have this party, and we'd love to have you there. So it means you need to get a ticket to the New Orleans Investment Conference, and then we'll tell you exactly how to find our suite party. To do that, it's super simple. Just send an email to New Orleans at realestateguysradio.com, and we'll get you all the details on that. But get out, see the people. We'll be back in Las Vegas at Freedom Fest over the summer, and Peter's going to be there. You'll find information about that on our website. We get to a lot of conferences because we want to get around folks who think some that like us, right? Like-minded people. There's a lot of good reasons to hang around like-minded people, but also people that think differently. Don't be scared to have a debate with somebody. You'll both learn. And in this case, we're not giving you the answers. Instead, we're urging you to think through, what is taxation and what do tariffs and what do all those things mean to me specifically as a real estate investor in the markets I'm in? That's up to you. Big thanks to Peter Schiff for sharing his time and energy with us. To learn more about Peter's brokerage business and to find out how to get his great books, including Crash Proof and The Real Crash, just send an email to Schiff@realestateguysradio.com. That's Schiff, S-C-H-I-F-F, at realestateguysradio.com. Also, big thanks to Kim Geithler and the folks at The Money Show, who are always very hospitable to us. And until next week, go out and make some equity happen.
This episode of the Real Estate Guys Radio Show is brought to you by Paradigm Life, powerful cash management strategies using life insurance. Learn more at beyourbank.com. Mid-South Home Buyers, low-cost, turnkey cash flow properties in Memphis, Tennessee. Corporate Direct, asset protection strategies for real estate investors from attorney and rich dad advisor Garrett Sutton. Find these and other great companies under the Resources tab at realestateguysradio.com. To learn how you can expose your product or service to the Real Estate Guys audience, call 888-489-7723 extension 4. That's 888-489-7723 extension 4. Or use the feedback page at realestateguysradio.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week right here on the Real Estate Guys Radio Show.